Parting Ways, Part 1 of 5, The Emergence of Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity, From Temple to Text, Law and Argument. I'm Dan Jacobs. If you're coming to this as audio, this is part 1 of a 5-part series on how Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity emerged from the same late Second Temple Jewish world, and how they parted ways over time. Religious splits are often told as if they were neat events, with a date you can pinpoint and a clear new identity. The story here is slower and more social. A disagreement that begins among neighbors can end up as a stock character in sermons and schoolrooms, and once that happens, the cost of treating the neighbor badly drops. This series follows the late Second Temple Jewish world as it broke and remade itself, the arguments, rival groups, and improvisations that eventually produced Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. For a time, the two projects coexisted in uneasy proximity, sharing texts and habits, before the boundary hardened, and the relationship became something very different. Before the fire, Hillel, the Pharisaic ethic. By the early 1st century, Pharisaic teachers already modeled a Judaism organized around teaching, legal debate, and lived practice, which mattered long before anyone knew the temple would fall. Hillel appears in the tradition as a way of showing how you can compress a moral baseline into one line and still insist that the real work is obligation and study. The later rabbinic texts insist that by the time of Jesus, there were recognized teachers, already a culture of debate for the sake of heaven, already a habit of turning Torah into lived embodiment rather than priestly procedure. Some of that is memory, some of it is myth-making. Either way, the picture was clear. Judaism was already learning to live through dialectic. In the rabbinic imagination, Hillel and Shammai sat at the crossroads of that pre-70 world. They were not presented as innovators who loosen Torah. They were presented as rivals who accept Torah's binding force and fight about how to read it. Modern readers often hear argument and assume relativism. The dynamic is disciplined disagreement inside a large tent. One Hillel story stands out as exemplifying a central theme of these sages. A Gentile came and offered to convert on one condition, teach me the whole Torah, standing on one foot. Shammai dismissed him abruptly. Hillel accepted him and answered, what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. That is the whole Torah, the rest is commentary. Go and learn. Read simply, it becomes. Judaism is basically be nice. But Hillel didn't end with kindness. He ended with obligation and study. Go and learn, was the punchline. The ethic wasn't a replacement for law. It was the entry point into it. That's a Pharisaic style of Judaism in miniature and ending. The text also has to be interpreted in real life, by real people, in changing circumstances. It's taught through compression, story, and disagreement, not only through priestly performance in one holy location. It also carries something later. Christian storytelling often claims as its own discovery, an ethical universalism that can speak to outsiders without first demanding insider fluency. On the rabbinic side, it foreshadowed a Judaism that could survive without a temple because it already knew how to locate holiness in practice, study, and ethics. If sacrifice was no longer available, you didn't start from nothing. There was an intensification of what already existed. Torah taught, argued, applied, carried in the mouth and the memory, and later organized into the Mishnah. On the Jesus side, it foreshadowed a way of summarizing law that would feel familiar when you read the Gospels. Jesus's habit of boiling the law down to love of God and love of neighbor lies within a Jewish ethical heritage that already talked this way. It set the stage for why the conflicts are so bitter later. The disputes were family disputes. They shared a language of moral summary and scriptural reasoning, and they competed over who represented Jewish scripture most faithfully. The temple was still the beating heart. In the early 1st century CE, the temple concentrated public worship, priestly dominance, and the city's festival economy in one place, so it was more than a religious site in the modern sense. That concentration shaped who had status, who had access, and what counted as public legitimacy. It also ran as an economy, animals, money changers, courts, patronage, status, and a social hierarchy that lived off the system. Jerusalem fell in 70 CE and the temple was burned. For centuries, sacrifice in Jerusalem had been the core public form of worship. A few decades later, after the Bar Kokhba revolt in the 130s CE, Jews were barred from living in Jerusalem. The city was refounded as the Roman colony Aelia Capitolina, and the province was renamed Syria Palestina, with consequences still felt today. By this point, there were already large Jewish communities across the Roman world, probably numbering in the millions. A Judaism that could function far from Jerusalem was already thriving. Now, making it work without Jerusalem became existential. The rabbinic project was the most successful answer to that problem. The early Jesus movement was another, taking a very different route at the same time. The world of Jesus, expectation in the air, Roman rule in Judea put pressure on ordinary life through tax, patronage, and periodic violence, and it made arguments about Jewish adherence feel practical rather than theoretical. In that setting, hopes for divine intervention and restored kingship circulated across different groups, with very different pictures of what intervention would look like. Messiah, Hebrew Mashiach, literally means anointed one. In the Bible, kings are anointed as God's chosen emissaries on earth. By the late Second Temple period, the Messiah was often imagined as a coming Davidic king who would restore Israel, push out oppressors, and re-establish a righteous Jewish polity. At Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls came from, you found a different type of expectation. Priestly and royal figures, messiahs of Aaron and Israel in some texts, along with apocalyptic war imagery. The Qumran sect texts spoke of a founding figure called the Teacher of Righteousness, portrayed as a divinely guided leader, and some scholars describe him as a messianic figure in that sect's own self-understanding. Then there is the baptizing revivalist strand around John the Baptist. He gathered a serious following. The sources even preserve the fact that some people wondered whether he might be the Messiah, while also insisting he denied it. The first century Jewish historian Josephus described many messianic claimants around this time, and how they were often put down, violently, by Rome. So when the Jesus movement began as a messianic Jewish sect, it wasn't inventing the idea. It was one expression of a wider current. Israel's God was about to act, and Rome would not have the last word. Revolt and certainty under pressure. When revolt starts to feel possible, the prophetic texts that were previously flexible get treated as predictive, and ambiguity becomes hard to tolerate inside a frightened community. Josephus's account is useful here, because he describes that shift in reading behavior and then tries to reframe it after the fact, in a way that also serves his own position. Messianic expectation doesn't cause revolt, but it helps explain the psychology that made revolt feel possible. If you believed God was about to intervene, compromise started to look like betrayal, and surrender felt religiously wrong. Josephus described an ambiguous oracle that people read as predicting a world ruler arising from Judea. He then insisted it really referred to Vespasian becoming emperor. In his telling, the method is interpretation under pressure. People read a phrase as certainty, and that certainty helped drive them into catastrophe. Josephus described a political dynamic we still recognize, a community that was frightened, humiliated, and furious. It wanted meaning. It wanted assurance. It took a pliable line and turned it into a prediction. Once that happened, caution started to look like cowardice, and prudence started to sound like apostasy. Rome destroyed the temple. But human certainty explains why the road to destruction could feel, to many, like the road to faithfulness. Yavne, and the story about how Judaism was saved. Rabbinic literature preserves a scene in which survival is framed as triage, choosing what can still be carried forward when the city cannot be saved. In that telling, Ben Zakkai's request to Vespasian is about rebuilding legal and teaching authority rather than recovering territory. Rabban Yohanan Ben Zakkai escaped a besieged Jerusalem and approached Vespasian. In the Babylonian Talmud's version, he flattered him as the future king, backed the claim with a proof text about Lebanon, a temple image, falling by a mighty one, and then made his request, "Give me Yavne and its sages." The story has curious mirrors to the way in which Josephus met Vespasian. We are reading a story preserved in later edited texts. Whatever the historical core, the story functions as a teaching about what it means to save something when you cannot save everything. From the priesthood to teachers, the Gospels polemicize against Pharisees, but they also assume that scribes and Pharisees are recognized public interpreters of Torah, which is an awkward premise for later Christian caricature. After 70, that assumption becomes historically suggestive because priestly rule had been tied to the sacrificial system, while teacher-based authority could operate without it. Matthew had Jesus tell the crowd that the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat and that people should do what they teach, even while condemning their behavior. Whatever you think Matthew is doing polemically, the line assumed that the Pharisees had the right theological and legal approach. After 70, this had significance. The Sadducees, a major Jewish sect in Second Temple Judaism, were tied to the priesthood. When the priestly system went, their public base went with it. A model built around teachers, law, and communal practice had a better chance of surviving without sacrifice. Jewish tradition presents the rabbinic project as continuity, Torah continuing to live through interpretation and practice, now carrying the weight the temple once carried. Scholars argue about the exact extent of that continuity. After 70, the project was to relocate the core of Jewish life from a building to a portable system. Torah as lived teaching, and the tradition of the oral law, became visible. Long before the Mishnah, Torah functioned in practice through teaching, remembered rulings, local courts, and arguments about how written law applies when circumstances change. Putting that material into writing later did not create the system from nothing, so much as make visible a way of running communal life that had already been working. Over time, the oral tradition was organized and written down in the Mishnah, and later expanded through the argument culture of the Talmud. Judaism became something that could live under foreign rule, far from Jerusalem, without priests supervising sacrifice. Portable didn't mean rootless. It meant you could build Jewish life in Alexandria, in Rome, in Babylonia, and later in America. You could have a calendar, a law, a rhythm, and a shared argument culture. You could keep Jerusalem inside the imagination without needing to live in it. Pirkei Avot and the chain of authority Pirkei Avot opens with a transmission list because legitimacy is the problem it wants to solve, not because it is offering detached historiography. The sequence links later teachers to Sinai through named intermediaries, which supplies a pedigree for rabbinic authority in a world without prophecy or temple. Moses received Torah at Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. The text traces through the elders, prophets, the men of the great assembly. It moves through named transmitters, through the Zugot, paired leaders, through figures like Hillel and Shammai, until it reaches the rabbis who stand behind the Mishnah's world. The point is to link rabbinic power to Sinai as an unbroken transmission, right up to the period where the rabbis ended up holding the pen. Avot sits at the start of the Mishnah, generally associated with redaction around 220 CE. Many traditions inside it are older, some are shaped by later needs. Rabbinic license is grounded in transmission, not in a fresh prophetic eruption, and not in a rebuilt temple. The rabbinic claim isn't, "We invented a new Judaism because the old structure collapsed." The claim is, "We are Torah's authorized continuation." Moses in Rabbi Akiva's classroom, a tradition that runs on interpretation, invites a basic worry about drift, because the distance between text and practice can start to look like invention. The Akiva classroom story stages that worry by making even Moses struggle to follow what is being taught, and then resolves it through the claim of Sinai-linked authority. Moses was transported into Rabbi Akiva's classroom. He sat at the back and could not follow what was happening. He was lost. The Torah being taught looked alien to him. Then Moses heard the line that settled his panic. When Akiva was asked the source of a ruling, he said it was a law given to Moses at Sinai. Moses was relieved, not because he suddenly understood the point being made, but because the story built a bridge. Law that looked wildly different from the written law was still presented as anchored in Sinai. Rabbinic creativity can look alien even to Moses and still count as authoritative. The Oven of Akhnai and the court that outranked God's voice. The Oven of Akhnai story turns a technical halachic dispute into a discussion about procedure because it insists that law is decided through authorized human processes, even when miracles appear. The drama draws a boundary around what counts as a legal decision in a post-temple world. A legal dispute broke out. Rabbi Eliezer argued on one side and called on miracles. A carob tree moved. Water ran backwards. Walls tilted. Then came the climax. A bat coal. A heavenly voice, declaring that the law is with Rabbi Eliezer. And he still lost. Even a heavenly voice didn't settle halacha, law, once Torah was treated as something entrusted to human hands. Rabbi Yehoshua replied, "Lo bapa shamayim heaven," a quote from Deuteronomy 30 verse 12. In the story's logic, the Torah had already been handed to human interpretation and communal decision. The majority of authorized judges beat miracles. Even heaven didn't override the rules now that the keys had been handed over. That was post-temple Judaism, in narrative form. Judaism could survive the end of prophecy, the end of the temple, and the failure of messianic politics because the law now lives inside a disciplined human institution. Bar Kokhba and the recoil from the messianic gamble. The Bar Kokhba Revolt, 132-135 or 136 CE, reintroduced messianic politics as an immediate program rather than a distant hope, and the fact that it briefly succeeded made the eventual defeat more psychologically and institutionally scarring. Rabbinic texts preserve both the attraction of certainty and the later recoil from it, which fits a broader shift towards survival through law, study, and communal routine under foreign rule. The authors preserved the messianic charge within it. In the Jerusalem Talmud, Rabbi Akiva saw Simon Bar Kokhba and said, "This is the King Messiah." Rabbi Yohanan ben Torta replied, "Akiva, grass will grow on your cheeks, and still the Son of David will not have come." Even if you treat this as a mythological memory, it captured a real turn in mood. Exhaustion with messianic certainty, and a sense that Jewish survival could not depend on God intervening with history. After the revolt, the ban from Jerusalem and the refounding of the city made something unavoidable. Jewish life would be, for the foreseeable future, dispersed. After 70, Judaism did not get to rebuild the temple. It rebuilt authority in a different place. Torah lived through law and argument and practice, held by teachers and courts, sustained by study and living the tradition. At the same time, the Jesus movement was moving through its own set of pressures. Still Jewish, still arguing about Torah, still reading Israel's scriptures, but pulled towards a version of belonging that could eventually scale through the Gentile world. And that's where the rest of the series goes. Part 2 stays with the Jewish Jesus movement, while the debate about Torah is still internal. Part 3 follows the demographic and theological shift, as Gentiles become the majority. Part 4 tracks the slow hardening of the boundary between church and synagogue. Part 5 looks at what gets carried forward and what gets turned into grievance, polemic, and habit. The written version, with links and sources, is in the show notes.